Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When Asia controls your bank account, and Asians control your technology, and Asians control your content, you have no choice but to listen.
You're listening to Crazy Smart Asia, a podcast exploring the unexpected stories of Asia's disruptors. And not many successful entrepreneurs have a more unconventional story than this week's guest. Jason Ma is a musician, entrepreneur, and investor best known as the co-founder of 88 Rising, a music label, talent management, and media company that focuses on bridging East and West through culture, technology, and entertainment. But if 88 Rising commissioned Gen T to produce the movie of Jason's life, it would be really difficult to know where to start. Should it be with his early run-ins with the law, the years he spent as a celebrity preacher and evangelist, or perhaps his career in music? Maybe it'd be when Bruno Mars featured on his third album, or when he launched the career of superstar Asian rapper and fellow Gen T honoree, Rich Brian. Or you could start with his career as an entrepreneur. His early years working for musician and investor MC Hammer in Silicon Valley, touring the likes of YouTube and Facebook when they had just a few employees. We might even start with his early investment in companies like Grab and Coinbase, leading with the story of how Paris Hilton helped him invest in TikTok. Thankfully, it's not a decision we have to make. Fitting the story into one podcast episode was tricky enough as it is. So in a slightly extended edition this week, Jason and Gen T's Lee Williamson discuss the unconventional path Jason took to business success, the power of cool, the importance of humility, and why the most difficult battle will always be with yourself. Oh, and they might also touch upon Jay-Z and the Illuminati. Much like the content he produces, Jason's life is pure box office. Strap yourself in for a wild ride. Here's our conversation.
Jason, I don't want to go through a chronological account of your career, or we'd be here all day. You've done a hell of a lot. But I think maybe a good place to start, something that really sums up who Jason Ma is a story you told me before. It's the three pictures that you drew as a kid when your parents asked you what you want to be. Can you tell us about that? What three things did you draw?
So when I was 7 years old, my father asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I took out a piece of paper and some crayons, and I drew three pictures of myself. First picture was me in a business suit with a suitcase and a tie in my hand. Second picture was me with a French Pierre cap and a paintbrush and a paint palette in my hand. And the third picture was me behind a church pulpit with a crucifix behind me preaching. And so my dad asked me in Cantonese, and my leg on, like, what is this? And I said, well, Dad, Monday through Friday, I'm going to be a businessman like you. Saturday, I'm going to be an artist. And Sunday, I'm going to be a preacher. And he said, Sang Mok Tai in Cantonese, which means you're a little smart aleck. And there you go. You know, 30 years later, here I am. I've experienced each of those phases of life and careers in some way, form, or fashion.
You have. A question I often ask people is to tell me your biggest, like, aha moment in life, like a huge realization that changed the course of your life. In your case, you had a massive turning point, right, when you were just a teenager in the way that you changed life direction. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I was a punk kid growing up. You know, I grew up with a single mom. Dad was in and out. It was a very dysfunctional situation. You know, we lived paycheck to paycheck. My mom was, you know, doing daycare. She could barely afford the rent. Sometimes we didn't even know food was going to show up. And, you know, it was just a school of hard knocks. And so for me, the way I found solace or acceptance or friendship was hanging out with the local gangs. And so there's a lot of local East Asian, South Asian gangs, mainly Vietnamese and Cambodian, in my neighborhood in San Jose, where I grew up, and just got myself into a bunch of trouble, got arrested a bunch of times, you know, did community service. I was selling drugs, growing weed at a young age. And, you know, I was getting into fights, but my biggest problem was I was addicted to stealing. And so I just stole because I got a thrill out of it. Like, it really gave me, like, an adrenaline rush. And I guess as a young kid with so much energy, it was like I had to put it somewhere. And unfortunately, I put it into a bad habit called theft. You know, I got caught twice for some reason. Each time I got caught, you know, the cops let me go. And I got probation, I got community service hours, but I never had to go to juvenile hall until the third time was when it got really serious. And that's when I was working at an Italian suit store in the Great Mall, which was in the Bay Area where I lived in San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland Bay Area. And I was working at this Italian suit store and I was stealing Armani Valentino suits with my buddies of mine that worked with me. There was three of us and we ran this little trifecta triad ring. And
you were just handing them out the back.
That's right.
I guess.
Counting them, miscounting them, you know, and misreporting. And we were selling tens of thousands of dollars worth of Armani Valentino suits every month. And we split it and we all made a bunch of money. And one day got a phone call saying from my mom, the cops were on the line. They said they have a hidden video camera of you stealing from your store and they're coming with a warrant to come arrest you. So I literally pick up a phone in my kitchen, I remember, and I called the cops myself. And I was like, hey, my name's Jason Ma. Heard you guys are coming out to arrest me. And I know you guys are BSing. You guys don't have any evidence. Catch me if you can. And they're like, we have a warrant out for you, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, sure, whatever. I hang up the phone. And I have this aha moment, this epiphany. I'm 16 years old, about to be 17. I'm getting horrible grades. My mom's praying for me and crying every day. I'm getting in trouble. I've been arrested. And I have everything. I have money. I have, you know, things that I wanted. But
yeah,
I just felt empty. And I didn't know what it was. And, you know, I have this weird thought, like, I need to come clean. And so I call my mom. My mom, I got to be honest with you, but I did it. And she was like, okay. And so she's like, what does that mean? I was like, well, I don't know what I should do. If I turn myself in, I'm probably going to go to jail. And she was like, well, I don't want you to go to jail. And so I'm like, okay, so what do I do? And my mom's like, I don't know. Give him a couple shirts. I'm like, Mom, that's not telling the truth. And right. In my head, I'm like, Mom, this is a random question, but, and I haven't been to church in 6 years. And I was like, what do you think Jesus would do if he was in my position? And true story, my mother literally verbatim said, Jason, Jesus, don't steal. And I was like, I know that, Mom, but if he was in my situation, what would he do? And she was like, well, he'd probably turn himself in to get rid of his sin so that he could get right with God and start his life over again. And when she said that to me, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I was like, this is what I need to do. I need to just fess up and get honest because I haven't just hurt others. I haven't just hurt myself. I've hurt God. And I was like, I need to get right with God. And so my mom's like, just pray to God that the cops have mercy on you. So I walk in the police station and the police are like, you're Jason Ma. They're ready to cuff me. And they see me with these two big garbage bags and they're not expecting me to tell the truth. And they're just like, what is all this? And I'm like, look, this is everything I have left. There's probably more out there, but I just want to come clean. And, you know, they're like, no, why are you doing this? I'm like, look, I'm just trying to get my life right with God. And they're like, interesting. And so the main cop was like, I haven't done this in 20 years of my career. He said, but when I saw you with two big garbage bags in your hand, it's like I heard a voice in my head say to me, there's something different about this kid. Give him a second chance. And I was like, what? And he was like, look, man, I think you're a good kid. Probably need some help and some therapy, but I'm going to let you go today. You're not going to have to post bail. But with your court case and your record, 99% chance you're still going to have to go to, you know, to jail. But, you know, at least I'll let you go for now. And I'm like, yo, that's enough of a miracle for me. And so
yeah,
he lets me go. And I'm like, what just happened? A bigger miracle happens. They let go of my, or they lose my court case for 6 months. You know, only get a letter in the mail within 2 to 3 weeks stating your court date. And that was Providence. During those 6 months, I became a Jesus freak. I flipped 180, went from straight S&Ds to straight A's, started, you know, getting along with my mother, right? Started a hip-hop Bible study, brought 100 of my friends that were from my, they're either my drug weed clients or shroom clients or, you know, my gang friends that I'd go and, you know, jump kids with or, you know, literally the theater department kids. And I brought them all to the hood in this little church in the east side of San Jose on Tuesday nights. We started this hip hop Bible study and I brought them to a Billy Graham crusade and they all got saved. And I started a little revival in my high school my senior year. And so lo and behold, 6 months later, a letter comes in the mail and says, you got to go to court. And I'm like, oh man, I guess I'm going to go start my jail ministry. I'm going to go to jail and tell people about Jesus in jail. And
you felt more ready for it, I guess, though, right? You started to put your life on the right track.
Yeah, I was just like, at that point, my life was in God's hands. It was no longer mine. And I was just like, you know what, God, wherever you take me, whether it's jail or outside jail, my life is yours. And I go to court. I plead guilty to all charges. They postpone my case 3 times. And the judge just pronounces me not guilty. He's like, you know, we made a decision and you can go free. And I'm like, what? I was like, I don't have to go to jail. He's like, no. I was like, do I pay the company back money? He's like, no. I was like, tell me I got, you know, like community service. He's like, no community service. I was like, what about like my probation officer? He's like, when you walk out this courtroom, she'll no longer be your probation officer. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. He's like, just get out of here. And I was just like, thank you, sir.
Yeah. What else do you say to that?
Exactly. And I walked out that courtroom, San Jose PD, downtown LA at the time, and looked up at the sky and was like, you know, sunny sky, birds chirping. And I'm like, God, you're the nicest dude I ever met in my life. And my life is yours.
Very few people get that kind of second chance, you know, beyond like a life-threatening illness. Like that level of like, you know, going from one direction and then turning around and doing a 180. And then, as you said, my life is yours. You then, there's many steps from there to being a missionary, but you eventually became a missionary. Is there a particular memory that defines that experience for you? I imagine you saw a lot of stuff, because I know you traveled the world preaching, a lot of traveling within the U.S. as well. I imagine you saw a lot of stuff that most of us can only imagine.
I've seen small miracles. I've seen big miracles. I've seen lives being changed, hearts being touched. I've seen supernatural things like people that couldn't walk all of a sudden walk. People that didn't have an eyeball all of a sudden have an eyeball grow out in front of my eyes. I've had...
What?
Yeah. Exactly. Like someone that's completely blind. Yeah, in Nepal, I remember. And this old lady laid hands on her and all of a sudden she like you could see something forming. She had no eye socket and literally an eye literally just formed in front of us and she could see. Everyone started screaming and everyone gave their life to Christ. Like there was stuff like that I saw and like exorcisms. That was like the stuff I saw the most of. I used to do exorcisms everywhere.
Do they look like they do in the movies?
Pretty exact. Yeah. Like you can see another body pushing through the physical body, right? You can see, I've seen heads twist, right? 360. I've seen tongues come out 2 feet long. I've seen eyes go completely black multiple times. People with crazy voices and languages that are not human. Levitation, seen that a few times.
Levitation, people literally hovering off the ground.
Yeah, and little girls with supernatural strength just throwing guys like 180, 200 something pounds, like toys, just throwing them off, like craziness. Yeah.
And so of the thousands of stories and memories, is there one that particularly resonates or that you still think about, you know, every day or very, very regularly that stays with you for whatever reason, whether it's heartwarming, whether it be shocking, whatever it may be?
I remember one time, this was early when I was a Christian, and I just started reading. And I remember the first day I read from Genesis to the end of Deuteronomy, which is basically the Pentateuch, the first 5 books, what they call in Hebraic terminology, the Torah. Those are the foundational books. And when I was done with Deuteronomy,
I kid you not, I felt like a bolt of electricity hit through the wall, go through my entire body, and I'm just like on the ground shaking, right? And I feel like electricity go through my entire body frame, and I'm shaking, and I don't know if I'm getting alien abducted. I don't know what's going on, but especially my hands and my fingers, I can't bend them. Like, I literally couldn't bend them, and I didn't know what was going on. I felt like this heat waves going through my hands. And then all of a sudden, it kind of just, after like an hour, it kind of just dissipated a little bit. I ended up reading the Bible, and I, in 4.5 days, from beginning to end, nonstop. I ended up the last 2.5 days not drinking any water, and not even having, I never ended up having a bite of the bread. But I felt so energized. And after each night when I was done, the same thing would happen. The presence of God would come. It would hit me like lightning. I'd get knocked out on the ground, and I would just like shake under God's power for like an hour or two. But the last day, it hit me so hard after I read the last passage in Revelation, and it said, "Do not let anyone add another word to this book. Amen." And I thought I was physically going to explode. The presence of God was so strong. I want to strip naked, and I literally started running around the Santa Cruz Mountains, yelling at the top of my lungs and telling the mountain across from me to throw itself into the sea, because that's how much faith I felt that I had. Of course, the mountain didn't do that, but you know, it was like this supernatural presence that was so, that you can never, no one can ever tell me that God's not real. I don't care if you're an atheist. I don't care if you believe in trees. I don't care if you believe in science and astronomy. I don't care. Whatever. Whatever I experienced there, I will never, ever in my life ever be able to deny the manifest presence of a supernatural God that exists. And that is something that no matter how dark or how light, how up or how down I am in my life and my journey, has always reminded me that God is real. And when you have an encounter with his presence, it's just undeniable.
What is your reaction when you tell people these stories and they say, you know, I'm a bit of a skeptic myself. I'm not a man of faith myself. You know, people who say things like that can be rationalized by the awesome unexplored potential of the human mind, of the human body, of so many things we don't understand. And that while the impact on you may have been massive and life-changing, it's not necessarily evidence of a divine intervention. Do you pity people like me because they don't understand that? Like, what's your, when people don't buy into those stories, what's your reaction?
I think everyone believes in God, but they choose to believe in the God that they want to believe in. So you either believe God is good or you believe he's bad. You either believe he's distant or you believe he's close, right? You either believe that he doesn't exist or he does exist. But everyone has a concept of God. And so for me, it's never, hey, you need to experience what I experienced. Because a lot of people, obviously, like, listen to these crazy ass stories I just shared. Like,
yeah.
Like, you're probably sitting here like, this guy's Looney Town, right? Like, what is he talking about? Like, this guy's legit nuts. Like, why am I even interviewing him on this podcast? So my thing is like, but I can't shake that experience. I can't, you know, undeny it myself, because that's something I experience. It's the same thing with exorcisms. Like, I've seen people levitate. Like I said, I've seen people talk in crazy languages and tongues come out their mouth that shouldn't be that long. I've seen, you know, things that are completely illogical, scientifically unexplainable, and defying the laws of gravity. And how can you deny that when you've seen it, right? If you haven't seen it, yo, I ain't faulting you at all, okay? Because go and believe in Einstein and believe in Darwinism and believe in science, because that is what works every day, right? I drop a pen and it falls to the ground, right? The laws of gravity are the laws of gravity. But if you experience something that is so contradicting to what we understand as possible, and then you experience something that is technically impossible, and then you try to figure out scientifically, like, could that be scientifically explained? But the way that you experience it, there's nothing that's telling you it can. You default to the belief that, you know what? That was supernatural. That was God.
It seems like you then took that into your life as an entrepreneur. So after many years of preaching and spreading the word of the Bible, being a missionary around the world, you then turn to business, which is interesting in itself because most people go to business, make a lot of money, and then find Jesus. Yes. You did it the other way around. But what I think is really interesting is you seem to take that, like, there is no impossible, only not done yet or not seen often, and you took that mentality into your business life. Can you give us a kind of a brief overview of what you did then from being a missionary and your early steps in the business world?
There's a lot of people that think Jason Ma is this fallen angel who was once high and holy with God and fell from grace and started partying in Hollywood and became this Hollywood, you know, agent entrepreneur, you know, and loving and enjoying the things of the world. And so a lot of people look at me as a walking contradiction. Like, how could this person that went from Holyville to Hollywood? And I don't blame them. If I was on the outside looking in, right, it was like you said, a lot of times you go and become the successful businessman or whatever. And after you made millions of dollars, you hear from God that you should give it all away and become a missionary or a pastor. That's a story that most people know. Most of the time you don't hear the inverse. You become this little junior Asian Billy Graham. And then all of a sudden you start a company like 88 Rising and give birth to a rapper like Rich Brian. Right. So like that just doesn't happen. Right. But you know, when I look at the life of Jesus, he was very unorthodox. Like, he got hanged for not being religious, right? He got crucified because he was counterculture to the religious elite, right? He didn't fit in to, you know, the religious confines and structures. And so there was a point where I remember I was praying one day, and at this time I was speaking to maybe 1,000 to tens of thousands of youth a night across the world in these evangelistic rallies. But I started getting really disillusioned. I just thought to myself, am I really making impact? And am I really touching lives by saying my prayers and giving my speeches and sermons over and over again? To me, I felt like the same group of kids at the same Christian conferences. And I thought about it. And I'm like, you know, there's conspiracy theories that Jay-Z is Illuminati, Freemason, you know, and he's, you know, deep into all this dark, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, darkness, right? And so I thought to myself, well, does Jay-Z go around to junior Freemason youth conferences and proselytize and evangelize and tell these junior Freemasons how to become one day a 33rd degree Mason, and if you do this and do it this way, you're just going to be the biggest, darkest badass in the world, right? For Satan, right? Like, and I'm thinking to myself, no, that is exactly not what Jay-Z does. What does Jay-Z do? He starts a record label called Roc Nation and Rockefeller Records, and who does he sign? Rihanna and Kanye West and Chris Brown or whoever all these artists are, right? And and he impacts the world subversively through media, through music, through fashion, through content, through film, through technology, through these few artists or disciples that then go and infiltrate millions and billions of eyeballs. So then I realized, wow, Jesus actually did the same thing. Jesus didn't spend most of his time preaching at conferences and big giant churches. He spent most of his time with 12 disciples, 12 artists that were signed to his 88 Rising. Okay. And what did Jesus do most of the time? He actually said it himself. He said, when he speaks to the lost, he never speaks with preaching or or religious words. He said he only speaks to the masses because eye has not seen and ear has not heard and heart cannot comprehend with parables. What are parables? Parables are stories. Okay. He always used stories to communicate. In other words, what are modern day parables? Well, they're films. It's Braveheart. It's A Wonderful Life. It's the movie Her. Mm. It's the movie Inside Out. It's the latest when all my friends right now are telling me you got to watch on Disney Plus this movie Soul. It'll change your life, right?
Yeah.
They're parables, yeah. Right? And who was Jesus's motley crew? These 12 young people that didn't give an F and willing to die for him, right? And be a part of this revolution, right? And so right. Anyway, so to me, Jesus sounds a lot more like Wall Street Bets on Reddit, mobilizing an army against the evil Wall Street and buying GameStop meme stocks. You know what I'm saying? Like that yeah. to me was the spirit of Christ. So anyway, so he's when I was praying, he spoke to me and he was like, Jason, you can either impact 1,000 in one night with your preaching, or you can impact 10 that will impact tens of millions, right? If you influence those who have influence. And so that was when I decided I'm going to leave. And I need to go back into media and entertainment. And I started my first music label / digital content network. And at that time, it was called Adventures.tv and ADVN. And it was with a group called Plan C, PCA. And that was, we had a management arm that managed a little group called Far East Movement, a rapper named MC Jin, and a little writer. That
this was early 2000s, right?
This was 2006, yeah. 2007. Yeah, that's when I yeah. first met Carl at the time. And then I invested in the company, and then everything literally sparked from there.
Yeah, you had a meeting with MC Hammer, which I think really catalyzed things with you as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, MC was actually before I was a missionary. MC was my first real boss. I was working at a startup in Cupertino, California, across from Apple Computer. Mm. And then I was running my hip-hop Bible study, and I used to listen to MC Hammer preach at this Sunday night Bible study, this mega church.
Yeah.
And it was like the greatest thing on earth. It's MC Hammer preaching, right? Reading the Bible to you.
Yeah.
And I had this good idea that I should invite him to come speak and perform at our once-a-year hip-hop outreach. And he said, I'm going to come and do it. I'm down. And then he looked at me, he's like, what do you do? And I was like, I work at this technology startup. We make small websites for small, medium-sized businesses. He was like, you're Asian. You must know how to use computers. You should come work for me. And I was like, what? And he was like, I invest in startups. I'm a venture capitalist. And the rest is history. I quit my job.
Right.
And he was at the ground floor of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and Salesforce when all these companies were less than 20 people each. It was crazy. And I used to just drive him around right. to all these meetings. I didn't know what was going on. But, yeah.
The second season of Crazy Smart Asia is sponsored by BNP Paribas Wealth Management. We live in a dynamic and ever-changing world where innovation leads the way. A world facing unprecedented challenges. We need to change the way we create and consume to fuel the next wave of change and build a brighter, more sustainable tomorrow. BNP Paribas Wealth Management is proud to support Crazy Smart Asia on its mission to tell the stories of inspiring leaders who are doing just that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to move on because I want to talk to you about that power of culture to influence, like you just mentioned. At Gen T, we write a lot about what's called the Asian century, right? It's the idea that the 19th century belonged to Europe, the 20th century was America's, and this is the century, the 21st, where Asia will rise. And that's not just hype, right? Like, it's actually transpiring, at least in terms of economic wealth. Within this year, within 2021, Asian economies are going to be larger than the rest of the world combined for the first time since the 19th century. But, right, in terms of cultural output, in terms of cultural influence on a global level, Asia is still nowhere near the West. It seems that you've bet your career on the idea that that's going to change soon. So I guess my question to you is, how is that going to happen? Like, what is the future look like for Asian culture and its, I assume, impending dominance?
Well, first we need to understand something, that Asia's existed a lot longer than the West.
Right.
Europe and the Americas is a very recent thing. This is not a multi-thousand-year empire culture as we know it. And so it's really just coming back to where it started, right?
Right.
And so, sure, I think because of American culture, whether it's Hollywood or whether it's sports or whether it's Wall Street, for the last almost 300 years, North America has dominated. And that's what the world has known. But it's very evident, as you said, who has the biggest economy in the world? Well, Asia. Who has the biggest military in the world now? China. Who has the most disposable income? Millennial and Gen Z Asian young people, not American youth. Who are more technologically advanced in social media? Asia, by a decade plus, right? And so when you just look at it by sheer number, and you look at it by just sheer demographic and geographics, it's inevitable that Asia is going to rise and Asia will become the most dominant force, not just in economics, not just in politics, but in culture. And so that's what you're seeing with the rise of K-pop. That's what you're seeing with movies like Parasite. That's what you're seeing, right, with the 88 Risings. This is just on the music level. But look at Hypebeast. Look at fashion. Look at food, right? It's like back in the day when I was Asian, because I'm older, right, it wasn't cool to be Asian. Now if you're a kid and you're Gen Z and you're on TikTok and you're wearing some Yeezys and some Supreme, you're going to be like, man, I want to look like what they look like in that K-pop video, right? What they look like in the streets of Shinjuku in Tokyo, what Hypebeast kids are wearing in Hong Kong, right? I want to look like that kid in my school. I'm this random little white kid with nothing, and there's this random international Chinese student at my high school with a Maserati, right? And you're just like, what is going on, right? And so the power play has totally switched. And it's clear and evident in the U.S.-China trade war, right? What are two things that the West is terrified of right now? It's very simple. China from the East, Asia, and Taliban from the West of Asia, okay? They are completely frightened, right? Because they know that Asia is taking over, right? And so I think really what's happening is, I'm not going to say it's the fall of the West and the rise of the East, but I think it's a transition from the quote-unquote influence and power of the West now fully transitioning over the next 10 years into the influence and the power of the East. And it's inevitable.
And do you think we're going to see a blending of the two as K-pop and Korean soap operas and movies and so on become popular in the West? You know, 88 Rising, one of the things you do is you bring, you know, you meld East and West culture together. In the next 10, 20 years, will there be a need for a company like 88 Rising? Will you need to evolve as, like, just naturally that starts to happen?
I think it's going to be no longer East-West. I think it's just going to become mainstream. And so, you know, I believe Asia still does not have its own CNN or BBC or Fox or Vice or New York Times, right? Maybe the closest would be a South China Morning Post or Tatler, right? Gen T, right? But even that is not penetrating
right? The streets of Los Angeles or the streets of Wall Street, right? And so
not yet.
But what's going to happen is Asia's going to have its own media voices, its own platforms, right? And the world's going to have to listen because they're not going to be able to not listen or afford to be given the opportunity to turn the other cheek or turn the other way and not listen because they control too much. When Asia controls your bank account and Asians control your technology and Asians control your content and Asians control your fashion and Asians control your access to energy and oil and power, you have no choice but to listen, right? And that was what the inverse was for the last, whatever, you know, 50 years. America controlled all these resources, right? Or all these assets. Yeah. And the world had to listen, right? But now America completely in disarray, divided. The Bible says if a house is divided, how can it stand? Like, I've never seen America like this in my entire life as a U.S. citizen, right? And I can I can confidently and convicted-wise say I am no longer in the America that I grew up in. This is not America anymore. This is a America that is divided and controlled by big tech and social media and cancel culture. Hashtag this, hashtag that. That's the new quote-unquote big brother. The new big brother is Twitter, right? The new big brother is Facebook, right? The new big brother is Google, right? And that, to me, is like, whoa, okay, you want to talk about CCP and communism? Well, why don't you go talk to Mark Zuckerberg? Right? Why don't you go talk to these powerful players that can shut down and shut up and bring up and bring down anyone they want? And so, anyways, my point is that when you have not just tens and dozens, but hundreds of books about the China threat, right? Thousands of podcasts, articles, it's because people see it. They perceive it. And they are anticipating and acknowledging that there's a new boss in town.
One of the things I want to get into is your ability to spot trends early. So talking about Silicon Valley, talking about the power of Facebook and TikTok and so on. You know, whether you were an early investor in TikTok, you got Bruno Mars to sing on your record before he was the Bruno Mars when you were a hip-hop artist in your earlier career. Or, you know, you were in Silicon Valley in the early days when YouTube was just a few people with a crazy, crazy idea. I think that's so important, right? I saw Jack Ma speak a few years ago, and the interviewer said, so what's hot right now? And he was like, the first thing is, whatever's hot, don't pay any attention to that because the opportunities have already gone. He's like, you got to look for things that are super, super cold. And it seems like you've done that a lot. You've got in before things got hot. But that's really difficult to do, right? Futurology is far from an exact science. So can you share any kind of insight? How have you been able to spot trends before they happen? Is there a kind of toolkit you go to, a kind of system?
I think that challenges or problems create opportunities. So I don't look for ideas. I look for problems. I don't look for innovations, I look for challenges. And that is where great entrepreneurs become. They recognize that there's a problem in the market that doesn't have a solve, and they recognize that they have access to resources and ideas that can actually answer those problems and create a solution. And so that is what a great venture capitalist or a great entrepreneur can discern and see, oh, kids don't have that, but they want that, but no one's providing that. And this idea or this product is serving that desire and need. So for instance, Musical.ly, right? When I found Musical.ly, when I can't say I found it, our firm, Goodwater Capital, we tracked it through our data software. We have an internal data software that scours the internet every day for 4 million apps. And we can see every piece of metadata, every download, every comment, every point of metadata and retention we're able to collect. So we can see all of a sudden, whoa, what's this little app called Musical.ly? Like, it's having kids spend like crazy, almost 40 minutes a day. Like, what is this? And then we go in and it's this weird 12 to 15 year old white kids doing karaoke, you know, sessions in 15
dancing
to 60
to
seconds.
Songs.
That's literally what music was, but it was so different and it was so engaging. And then it was so different than anything we had ever seen. It wasn't Twitter. It wasn't YouTube. It wasn't Facebook. It was a whole nother way of interacting. And there wasn't anything in the market that was taking music and short form social into one and making it dynamic, right? The closest up to that point was Vine. And so right when I saw it and we saw the numbers, we were like, oh, there's something to this, right? And so I actually was in Shanghai, I remember, because we were fighting for an allocation. The other top VCs in the Valley were, you know, basically oversubscribing this early round. And I remember Chihua was like, Jason, you got to help us because we got to show the founders, this guy named Lewis and June, that we will bring real value. Like, can you bring some celebrity, you know, to them to show them that, you know, our firm can really bring the juice. So I happened to be in Shanghai with Paris Hilton. And I know it sounds random. So I was with Paris at the time and she was there for Shanghai Fashion Week. And I was like, Paris. And you know, Paris is actually an innovator too. I mean, she created what we know as modern day influencer, right? And so she she's actually really smart in that sense. She sees trends as well. And I was like, Paris, check out this app. And she's like, oh, that's crazy. Like, how do you use it? And I was like, you just gotta just record it, just kind of put a song to it, just like, you know, mix it up. And she's like, all right. And I was like, you gotta come with me to meet the founders. They have their office in Shanghai and they're gonna freak out. They're gonna freak out if you come and you'll be the first real celebrity on Musical.ly. Because up to that point there was no real celebrity on Musical.ly. So I literally bring in Paris Hilton. She was wearing, I don't know what she was wearing, she's looking hot as hell. All right. And she's walking in to Musical.ly's office and there's like 40 little Shanghainese kids, right? Like little engineer kids and product kids, just like. And we sit down and literally the two founders show her how to use the app. And then she posts her first Musical.ly and then we fly to Macau and I tell them, hey, part of the, if you give us this deal, we're going to have Paris live stream for the first time on Musical.ly, her DJ set for her party and her club event in Macau. And we did that. They freaked out. And then I was like, and if you give me a bigger allocation, I'm going to get you Ariana Grande. And they and long story short, we delivered, brought Ariana on the platform. And that was how we got to invest in Musical.ly early. And then, of course, within 18 months, it got acquired by ByteDance.
And became TikTok. So, I mean, what I'm getting there is, like, really one of the key things is how do you spot trends early? You have a nose for it, for sure, which has to be trained. But also, you use a huge amount of data. You had this huge kind of spider web crawling millions of apps and seeing the level of engagement, and you could see what was there. But then you took that, and then you used the power of cool, which is also something I want to ask you about because, you know, the power of cool has been a big factor in a lot of your ventures in kind of driving them forward. Like case in point, Triller, right? Which you're also involved in, which in some ways is a rival to TikTok. You know, you're kind of hedging your bets there. But TikTok is paying musicians and content creators to upload videos. Whereas you've said before that the biggest artists in the world are uploading their videos to Triller for free, right? So you can't buy that kind of marketing. So many brands try to be cool, and it blows up in their face massively and publicly. How do you create buzz for like the people listening, entrepreneurs who are building like a B2C product? How do you build buzz and cool around a product or around a brand?
Well, it always has to be authentic, right? When we were little, the Triller was tiny. It was like 2 years ago. Literally on the same day, DJ Khaled gets paid seven figures to post on TikTok. And the next day, within a 24-hour period, he uploads a Triller video without us asking him. And he goes, it's all about Triller. It's all about Triller in his private jet plane. Something happens. Stussy or Massimo or a brand from Walmart can pay DJ Khaled $10 million to wear their t-shirt or hold their bag. Supreme will never have to pay DJ Khaled to hold a Supreme bag or wear a Supreme t-shirt. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's about how you position the brand and how you create the content or the perception of what that brand stands for. Right. And Triller was always uniquely different. When I saw Triller back in 2018, it was niche, similar to TikTok, but mainly focused on Black and Brown and South Asian culture in America. It was mainly the hip hop culture, right? It was mainly rappers and dancers and hip hop culture creators creating content on Triller. And a lot of the early rappers and the early community of Triller did it because they saw other rappers on Triller, and they saw other rappers on Triller, and they saw other artists, and they saw other dancers, and they're like, hey, you know, it's cool with them, it's cool with me, right? Same effect with music. You have a little white kid in a suburb, right, in Wisconsin, and that affects another little white kid in the suburb of Arkansas, right? So it just automatically hit its own demographic. And I believe in the Blue Ocean strategy, which is focus on one thing. Always focus on one niche, right?
Yeah.
If you focus on that one thing, you can have everything, right? And so Jay-Z started with one thing, being an incredible rapper. 30 years later, he owns the Brooklyn Nets, okay?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what's that one thing, right? And so for me, I knew hip-hop had become a part of Triller's culture and brand. And I was like, own it, own it, own it, own it, own that, right? Because if you own the streets, you own the culture. You own hip hop, you own the pop charts, right? And that goes to the masses. And so went with that edge, and immediately it became something cool. And like you said, the power of cool. When something's cool, you don't need to pay for cool.
Yeah.
Cool is not paid for. Cool is innovated, ideated, and created.
We'll be right back with Lee and Jason. But first, let's hear from Grace Tam, Chief Investment Advisor, Hong Kong, at BNP Paribas Wealth Management. She talks to Lee about the Asian century and the opportunities investors should be looking out for.
With Jason Ma, we're talking about this being the Asian century. How is this transpiring in the key industries fueling Asia's rise?
Technology, as you know, is always a focus, and Asia is the manufacturing powerhouse for a number of tech products, for example, like smartphones, and in particular for semiconductors that power almost every chip in the world. And leading manufacturers in Taiwan and also South Korea, they are front runners of high-end chips. And also, Asia is now considered an active hotbed for innovation across a spectrum of industries like fintech, healthcare, and robotics.
Increasingly so, the rest of the world is trading with Asia. What are the early opportunities that investors should be looking out for?
Alternative investments. For example, private equity have been gaining popularity in Asia for high net worth investors. Institutional investors, for example, like sovereign wealth funds, university endowments, etc., they all have a decent exposure to private equity for portfolio diversification. The weakness of investing in private equity is always its lack of liquidity. Having said that, longer-term investors, they are rewarded with potentially more attractive expected returns by sacrificing short-term liquidity.
With the disruption that COVID-19 has caused, how would you describe the post-pandemic Asian investor?
No doubt, the pandemic has accelerated the digital trend, and this explains the impressive rally of the tech sector last year. And apart from tech, climate investing and sustainable and responsible investments, or SRI, are gaining traction. Stimulus packages from many governments in the world to revive their economies have included a lot of green agenda items, as many countries have set aggressive targets to reduce carbon emissions. And we also have been seeing strong inflows into the SRI or the ESG themes.
And now back to the show.
Ed tech has changed media so much in the past 20 years. right? Like the old hegemony of the big networks and the big studios on content has gone because of technology, because anyone can build an app and anyone can be where everybody's paying attention to anymore. You don't need a broadcast license. You don't need to print a newspaper. That has absolutely changed everything. And your career has really all been at the confluence of tech and media the whole time. I think, you know, one of the key distinguishing factors has really been you didn't wait for the system, the traditional system for Hollywood, for big studios to give you your shot. You just went and created your own systems, right? You didn't bang on Hollywood's door. You found these new platforms or got in early and developed these new platforms and brought them to Hollywood. I think that taking control of your destiny and controlling your path is really the core of what being an entrepreneur is. So how do you do that? And what advice can you give to entrepreneurs based in Asia who want to know what's their secret sauce? How do you do that?
Well, as has been quoted or said many times, I'll paraphrase it. It's like, don't wait for your seat at the table. Create your own table.
Yeah.
And I always knew no one was going to help me. Right? Meaning, I came from nothing. I came from the streets. I came from a single parent family home. I came from a house that didn't know if we're going to eat the next night or be able to make rent that month. I didn't come from an affluent Chinese family. I didn't have connections. I didn't have anything. So I knew from the very beginning, I had to learn to figure out real fast how to survive. And once you can get through that Maslow hierarchy of basic survival, like food, clothes on my back, house over my head, once I got that part figured out, okay, then I could actually think about, okay, what else is possible, right? And at every given moment, my point is, I knew no one was going to give me a hand out, to give me a hand up, and I never waited or expected anyone to help me get anywhere, right?
Yeah.
And so I always had the mentality that no one's going to help you but yourself, right? And if no one's going to help you but yourself, everyone always says this, God helps those who help themselves. That is not in the Bible, okay? that is not in the Bible. But
and we know now that you know it's not in the Bible.
But there's a ton of truth in that. God helps those who help themselves. And I always used to say, pray like it all depends on God, but live like it all depends on you. In other words, no effing excuses, okay? Like, you work your ass off. You work hard towards something that you want. And if you put your mind to it and you invest your 10,000 hours, it's 90% blood, sweat, and tears. And yes, it's 10% luck, right?
Yeah.
But if you do the right thing, not because it's going to make you money or make you famous or make you powerful, but you do the right thing over and over again because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you will achieve what you're out to achieve. And I'm not saying that for everyone, but I am saying that end of the day, you got to do it yourself.
You've got to do it yourself. You've got to put in the 10,000 hours. You've also got to have an eye on the future, right? To look at those, so not looking at what's possible and what's not possible now, but looking at, it seems like you've always looked at what's going to be possible and putting in the 10,000 hours to getting ahead of the game.
I think the people that I've met who are the brightest, the wisest, and the most disruptive are humble.
Yep.
They are always learning. They are always observing. They are always reading. They are always listening. They're more observant than they are talking. They watch and they recognize that they know what they know, but they don't know it all. Humility is absolutely critical to a heart that's in a position that is willing to absorb and learn and grow. If you stop listening, you stop learning. If you stop learning, you stop growing. If you stop growing, you become stagnant. If you become stagnant, you eventually deplete and die. What makes us progress is not our physical body, it's our mind. And if you can continually feed the mind and grow the mind and sustain the mind
with new information that is healthy information, correct information, positive information, stimulating information, challenging information, you can continually grow and things, even more possibilities become possible.
Right. And I'm going to ask you a couple of final questions, Jason. This is a question that I ask to every guest on this podcast. You're a successful person. A lot of people want to be sat in your chair where you are right now and won't get there for whatever reason. What do you think is the one difference that has got you to where you are today?
Resilience. Not making excuses. Learning to right my wrongs and correct my mistakes and find good people around me that know more than me to advise me on how I can become a better version of me. And that takes a lot of humility, a lot of fighting through depression and anxiety, and a lot of self-acceptance to accept yourself in the midst of your flaws and your weakness and to still move forward. That is not an easy thing to do because most people, after they lose once, they quit. After they lose twice, they quit forever. After they lose three times, they just fully give up. Like someone asked Elon Musk, you know, what type of encouragement would you give to entrepreneurs who want to succeed? And he said, if you're an entrepreneur, if you want to be an entrepreneur and you need encouragement, don't be an entrepreneur. Because it's a thankless, no encouragement job. And the more successful you are, the more people hate you, the more people despise you, the more people judge you, the more people think you're evil, the more people want to take from you, want to take you down, want to kill you, right? It's you become a target for people's insecurities. And, you know, I don't really consider myself successful. I don't think, you know, I'm some anything, but I will say this, I am the most successful version of myself and there's still a lot more to improve, but my competition every day is not you or you or you. My competition is me. And that's just what I'm trying to win at, is just become a better version of me on a daily basis.
And if our listeners take away just one insight from this conversation, is it that? Is it, to quote a hip-hop reference, as Kendrick said, be humble?
To me, the one word that I follow as a mantra is humility. If I'm not hungry every day, then I stop growing as a person. And hunger comes from humility.
Jason, thank you so much. This has been such an interesting conversation.
I hope I didn't freak you out, but it was quite fun. And thank you for hearing all the different variances of my life in the last hour. It's been a fun conversation.
That's it for another episode of Crazy Smart Asia. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to this. And please do leave us a rating and a review while you're at it. Next week, I'll be talking with Binod Chaudhary, politician, philanthropist, entrepreneur, and Nepal's only billionaire. In a fascinating conversation, we touched on risk, resilience, and the one thing entrepreneurs need to succeed that no business school will teach you. I can't wait to share it with the world. Until then, try to remember,
Jesus, don't steal.
See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.